Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What next on the debt limit now the talks have broken down? For that matter, what if we didn't need a debt limit at all? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering its Raise Your Rate CD as well as an online savings account and money market account. Learn more at allybank.com. Marketplace Innovation Reporting is supported by the 2011 Jaguar XJ. Learn more at a local dealer or at jaguarusa.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Risdahl. It is Friday today, the 24th of June. Glad to have you with us. And TGIF never sounded so sweet, I'll tell you that. But in the corridors of power in Washington, D.C., there is no rest for the weary, for we are still without a budget deal. We are, in fact, even without talks on a budget deal as of yesterday. You roll that in with a slow economy, Greece and its debt worries, a stock market that is skittish. I could go on, but I won't. I will instead open things up for Lizzie O'Leary from Bloomberg News, Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville, and a live radio segment that we like to call the Weekly Wrap. Hey, guys.
Hi.
Hey, Kai.
So, Lizzie, I'll tell you, you're sitting there in Washington, fingers on the very pulse of political power, so you get the first question. That whole thing with Eric Cantor yesterday pulling out of the debt talks and John Boehner giving his press conference, that was all just choreographed and set up and scheduled, and they're going to reach a deal, right?
Gee, that would be great to know the answer to that. It could be choreographed. Cantor's aides say it wasn't. There is a lot of substantive talk going on here, and then there's some political theater behind it. Yes, there will be more talks. Yes, the president is getting involved. The Republicans wanted to ratchet this up to the point where they said, okay, Mr. President, you have to talk about it. We are, of course, getting closer and closer to that August 2nd financial Armageddon right. That the Treasury Secretary has talked about. But the problem here is Democrats want some sort of revenue raiser, i.e. more taxes, in this thing. And Republicans say, no way, that won't get past the House.
So, Cardiff, I saw a great line this morning, and I forget, frankly, where it was or I'd give him credit. It basically went like this. Congress trying to figure out the debt talks is like a caveman disarming a nuclear bomb with a club. I mean, the markets are finely tuned. They're delicate instruments most of the time. And Congress doesn't really know what it's doing.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think from the beginning, though, we've known that the incentives here, the political incentives have been for this thing to go all the way down to the wire. The Republicans in particular don't want to be accused of not having gotten the best deal. So I really don't have much hope that we're going to see a resolution to this anytime soon. I do think we're going to get up right up close to that August 2nd deadline. The really interesting question for me is, how will the markets react in those days leading up to it? Well, and one way or the other, I think we're going to find out.
Well, Lizzie, give me your sense. I mean, do you think that people in Washington really understand that the markets don't appreciate the whole midnight August 2nd thing, that for them it starts getting really, really skeevy like, you know, last week of July?
Well, the problem with that is people go back and look at the other times this has happened. If you look at 92, 94, 96, there are a number of historical cases, and in those cases, the markets didn't react. Mm. And so I think it's hard to convince politicians that this is different, that this might be different, that when you talk to budget experts, they say, yeah, but then the overall economy was not in the fragile place that it is right now. The overall fiscal situation then was better.
Yeah. All right. So, Cardiff, step back for me for a minute. You know how at the end of the newscast I always say, you know, in Wall Street today, it was whatever the cause of the markets. Today, I'm going to say something about Greek debt, probably, just because that's what's on everybody's mind. But really, the markets have been skittish. I mean, yesterday was, you know, salvaged because the Greek debt there was a deal negotiated, maybe. And today it was lousy because they're worried about Greek debt. I mean, it's already really, really skittish.
Oh, of course it is, and I don't think we should be surprised about that. I always hesitate to read too much into intraday movements. At the same time, this Greek debt deal, I mean, it's really clear what it means just yet. It still has to pass the Greek parliament next week, and that's a body that, by the way, makes the U.S. political system look like a bastion of harmony and coordination. And you also had this surprise IEA announcement. Oil prices were plummeting. Numbers in the U.S. are still terrible. So it's hard to say exactly what's moving the markets in any given day. We really shouldn't be surprised by the kind of volatility we're seeing these days.
Lizzie, your sense of Washington and volatility, I mean, they are looking at the markets, right?
Sort of, but I think if you, you know, went around polling Congress asking them what the VIX was, I'm going to say it would not be something a lot of people knew.
There's going to be a quiz at the end of the broadcast.
There will be a quiz.
That's right.
But look, I think they have some sense that this is volatile, but politicians, particularly those in an election cycle and coming into a presidential election year, don't think in the same way that people on Wall Street do. They just don't.
Yeah. Cardiff, last word to you. You got like 15 seconds.
Sure.
Next week, crazy week, end of the quarter, lots going on. Budget talks pick up Monday. Where are we going to go?
I like I said earlier, I really don't think we're going to see any kind of meaningful progress until the end of July. And by the way, since I've only got a few seconds left, here's a scary thought for you.
Lizzie was talking about the... No, I'm kidding. Go ahead.
Okay. Lizzie was talking about the 2012 election, how it's going to be crazy. Let's say the debt ceiling does get raised this year after some kind of, you know, miraculous deal, all right? We're probably going to have to deal with the same thing next year because it's probably not going to be raised by too much more because the Republicans know now that this is something they can use as leverage.
All right. Now we really got to go. Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville, Lizzie O'Leary from Bloomberg News. Have a good weekend, you guys.
Thanks, too. Kai.
So all three major indices, I'm not going to say the Greek debt thing, by the way, they gave it up to the tune of about 1% or so. Oil, as Cardiff said, stayed pretty much right where it landed yesterday, about $91 a barrel. Details, numbers, when we get there. So we are, as of this Friday in late June, a bit more than 5 weeks away from the government hitting the debt limit, as we were just talking about. $14.3 trillion, not a single penny more. Conventional wisdom has it that when the Treasury Department can't bar to pay our bills anymore, very, very bad things happen. But here's a not unrelated thought. What if the debt ceiling just isn't constitutional? What if the president just ignored the limit, told Timothy Geithner and the gang over at the Treasury Department to keep on selling bonds and paying what we owe? Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has more now on the latest economic trial balloon.
Here's how the argument goes. When Congress passes spending bills, it knows there isn't enough cash to pay for it all. And by approving those obligations anyway, Congress is implicitly committing the government to borrow the money to meet them. By later imposing a limit on borrowing, which is what the debt ceiling is, Congress is illegally counteracting its own laws.
Let's face it, the reality is having a separate vote on the debt ceiling makes no sense.
Norman Ornstein follows Congress and the executive branch for the American Enterprise Institute.
The debt ceiling is a reflection of the debts that you have already incurred. And every time Congress passes a budget, it's obligating itself to future debts.
So when it approves a budget, Congress requires the president to meet those obligations by borrowing if necessary. If he continues to borrow, the president would have to ignore the second congressional mandate to not breach the debt limit. In the inevitable legal challenge to such a decision, University of Baltimore Law School professor Garrett Epps cites a clause in the 14th Amendment to the Constitution.
Section 4 says the validity of the public debt of the United States, including debts incurred for payment of pensions and bounties and suppression of rebellion, shall not be questioned.
That amendment was adopted just after the Civil War, when Southern lawmakers were questioning the Union Army's debts.
That language would provide a serious basis for going outside the congressional debt ceiling process.
But snubbing the debt ceiling would be a nuclear option, says Princeton historian Julian Zelizer. He doubts President Obama will go for it.
He is a pragmatic politician. His bias is to cut a deal. That's where he always moves. And so I don't think he's just going to ignore the debt ceiling.
Still, congressional Democrats are thinking about lobbying the president to breach the limit, but only as a last resort. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
We just covered debt, so let's turn to the other main storyline of this economy, jobs and growth. It's really one story. Unemployment's at 9.1%. The gross domestic product number that came out this morning showed the economy is still growing slowly, though. And there's an intuitive connection between the two. More growth means more jobs, just stands to reason. But commentator and economist Justin Wolfer says there is actually a formula the experts like to use, And in our economy today, things just don't add up.
The latest economic forecasts suggest that output will grow by about 3% in each of the next few years. That sounds like the basis for a useful economic recovery. But it's not. There's an old rule of thumb called Oken's Law, which links economic growth with unemployment. This rule says that when you can get the economy to grow faster than 3%, then unemployment will fall. But growth rates of 3% won't lower the jobless rate. Unfortunately, that's the forecast. You see, it's not enough just for output to rise. If we can make that extra stuff just by working harder or smarter, unemployment won't fall. There's also population growth, which means we need to grow just to absorb new entrants to the labour market. And there are millions of discouraged workers who will return to the labour market as soon as there are jobs to be found. The economy is stuck in a strange kind of limbo. The good news is that it isn't shrinking and the crisis is over. But the bad news is that it isn't growing fast enough to get unemployment down. With the crisis behind us, the urgency is gone. But the unemployment problem remains. Now, the same forecasters who are predicting tepid economic growth are also predicting unemployment will fall. This has me puzzled because tepid growth rarely lowers unemployment. These forecasters are effectively predicting the end of Oken's Law. But why? And are we really ready to bet our economic prospects on this? I'm not. It just doesn't add up. Instead, I fear we're seeing a severe case of wishful thinking. Next time you hear a politician talking optimistically about the recovery, remember, normal growth isn't enough. Reducing unemployment requires a lot more than what we're seeing.
Justin Wolfers is an associate professor at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. Send us your comments. Marketplace.org is the website. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, life on the lowest rung of the music ladder.
I can't flip a switch and become Lady Gaga. I can't do anything but what I do, which is why I do it.
Us? We got to do the numbers. Nail-biting over Italian banks and the Greek debt. Yes, it's a European twofer. Led to a third day of market losses on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials bit off 115 points, nearly 1%. Closed at 11,934. The NASDAQ nibbled away 33 points, about 1.25%, 2652. The S&P 500 snipped off 15 points, about 1.1%, ended at 1268. For the week gone by, the Dow left a 0.5% on the table. The NASDAQ climbed 1.4%. The S&P 500 nicked off a 0.25%. Some technology stocks took a hit today. Oracle reported lower hardware sales. I don't know what hard whales are. They sank 4%. The 10-year T-note rose. The yield fell to 2.87%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill, working with customers around the world to connect ideas to opportunities across food, agriculture, finance, and industry. Information at Cargill.com. And by FreshBooks, an online invoicing service for freelancers and small businesses designed to help save time, look professional, and make invoicing easy. More at FreshBooks.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Farmers Insurance, trained local agents committed to small business success. More at 1-866-200-4BIZ. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on income and spending for the month of May. Deficit reduction discussions take place at the White House. President Obama and Vice President Biden are scheduled to hold separate meetings with the Senate Majority Leader and the Senate Minority Leader. And writer-producer-director J.J. Abrams turns 45. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As I was talking about with Mr. Garcia a bit earlier in the broadcast, next week is going to be a heck of a week business and economy-wise. On Wall Street, it's the end of the quarter. Congressional debt talks are going to heat up before the July 4th recess. Whether they get anywhere is another question. But in a lot of states, it's the end of the fiscal year. So the clock is ticking for legislators scrambling to cut expenses and paper over their fiscal problems and get a budget deal done. As we've already seen this year, state employees are convenient targets. Yesterday, lawmakers in New Jersey voted to cut state employees' health and pension benefits. And today, a union vote in Connecticut rejected a cost-cutting deal, sparking a budget standoff in the Nutmeg State. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has more.
Connecticut lawmakers thought they had a budget compromise involving shared sacrifice, some spending cuts, of course, and also some tax increases, and some concessions by state employees on benefits. The union leadership was on board, but members voted to kill the deal. Matt O'Connor is spokesman for a coalition of state employee unions.
I hate to use the term dead, but yes, the agreement is not ratified.
He says most members actually voted in favor of the agreement, but it takes a higher threshold than usual to change health care benefits. Connecticut Senate President Donald Williams says the union's move plays into the hands of its enemies.
This was perhaps the worst time for public sector employees in Connecticut to turn down reasonable concessions and therefore contributing to what some people are already pushing as a political agenda, which is that public sector employees just don't get it.
Eileen Norcross is with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University.
Unions protest at the drop of a hat if you even, you know, look at a pension system. And we're seeing that in New Jersey. We're seeing that in Atlanta, Georgia. We're seeing that in Wisconsin. And I think it's self-defeating.
Norcross says the pension problems are generally worse than states admit.
States are systematically underestimating how big their pension liabilities are due to an accounting rule. It's going to take a lot more for them to patch the hole in these systems.
Normally, Connecticut's legislative session would be over by now, but lawmakers have to go back to work next week to find a new solution to the budget shortfall that could mean laying off more than 7,000 state employees. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Should you find yourself watching a little Wimbledon this weekend, you may see an ad between the aces and the volleys that's not really meant for you. It's more aimed at the kid sitting next to you on the couch. Andrea Gardner explains tennis is doing all it can to get a share of the youth market.
Good shot.
Think of it as the tennis version of t-ball. 9-year-old Brianna Rubio is one of 120 kids practicing ground strokes at Harvey Elementary School in Santa Ana, California.
Hit the ball and stay focused on the ball and not let it go out of the lines.
Her coaches are using a teaching method known as 10 and under tennis. The nets are lower, the courts are about half the size of standard courts, and the balls are specially designed to move more slowly with less bounce. The United States Tennis Association is planning to spend about $8 million this year to promote 10 and under tennis, with a nationwide ad campaign and grant money to local programs. The one at Harvey Elementary got $5,000. Kirk Camperman heads community tennis programs for the USTA.
We felt that we needed to make the game more fun and allow kids to be more successful more quickly.
That's because tennis is facing competition from sports that kids can pick up more easily, like soccer.
You can put, you know, 26-year-olds on a soccer field and kick the ball, and it's just like a horde of bees just chasing it. But everybody feels like they're playing and having fun.
With tennis, not so much. 6-year-olds don't have the height or coordination to control a traditional ball on a standard-sized court. And by the time they reach a more appropriate age for tennis, many kids have already committed to other pastimes. Peter Carlisle is a consultant with Octagon Sports Marketing.
You're really having to market your sport to the same group of kids, and they're being forced to make a decision at an age where they probably either haven't tried your sport or haven't experienced it in a realistic way.
The push comes at a challenging time for tennis in the U.S. Tennis is a $5.5 billion business here. According to the Tennis Industry Association, that includes equipment, clothing sales, club memberships, tournament attendance, and TV revenue. But the number of self-described frequent players has been flat for the past 10 years, and the ranks of American champions on the world stage has been on the decline. decline. USTA hopes 10 and under tennis can help reverse both trends. Camperman says European countries have had similar programs for decades.
We think we can get just masses of more kids introduced to the game and keep them in the game. And if we do that, we're going to have a larger pool of athletes.
Sports marketing consultant Peter Carlisle says few things draw more attention to a sport than a high-profile champion. He points to what Tiger Woods did for golf or Tony Hawk for skateboarding.
It's like the chicken and egg argument, because you sort of need the star to grow participation, and you need participation to grow the star. And so I think most sports that effectively market themselves do focus on both of those things.
The USTA hopes young players like Brianna Rubio will hatch into full-fledged competitors.
Do you think you could be the next Serena Williams?
Yeah.
In Los Angeles, I'm Andrea Gardner for Marketplace.
You want to make it in the music business? You're going to have to figure it out for yourself, because the old rules are long, long gone. Most recent case in point, singer-songwriter Alina Simone.
Hot sand, the smell of diesel on the back of my hand. The map is fading, the photographs blow out in a string of flowers.
She was discovered by a book editor. Of all things, he'd heard some of her songs online. He became a fan and, to her surprise, offered her a book deal. To his surprise, the essays she wrote are funny, actually funny. They're collected in a new book called You Must Go and Win. It's all about building a career in the trenches of indie rock. Alina Simone, good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
So this is not your typical musician biography. You know, I mean, Keith Richards is out there, Patti Smith is out there, and, you know, they tell all kinds of tales. It's stories of flea-bitten mattresses and skeevy Craigslist ads and producers who are more interested in a second house in the Hamptons than they are in your music career. Why'd you stick with it? I mean, there comes a point when even the most determined person, whether they wanted to do it when they were five or not, says, I can't do this anymore.
It's because I was absolutely compelled to do it. And I think that that's the answer any artist would give you if you asked them, you know, you wanted to be a writer and your book got rejected 28,000 times and no one wanted to be your agent and 17 years passed before you finally broke through. Why do people do that? It's because they have to. It's the expression of who you are. And if you look back at your life and you didn't even try to do what you dreamed to do, then that's really tragic. That's tragic, and it's not funny. It's just tragic.
You know, so speaking of tragedy, I mean, your most recent album before this one that's out was all in Russian, about an ill-fated Russian poet. Do I have that right?
Yeah, a punk poet. She's a singer and a poet.
Right. Mm-hmm. You're not playing to a fan base here. You're doing your thing.
That is very accurate. I wouldn't say there was a loud clamor out there that I was answering for covers of deceased Soviet punk singers. I fell in love with her music. I became totally obsessed with it. I felt that it deserved to be reinterpreted.
You have in your book it's a roadmap of sorts. It's a graphic or a chart that says, listen, if you're an artist, here's what you have to do. And you lay out a bunch of things. You have to go to see a publicist and lawyers and press and all kinds of things. And then you have one where you have to connect with your fans. And I want you to read the little bit right there about connecting with your fans.
Howard Wolfson is going to kill me. In the summer of 2008, I got an order for an album I self-released and was selling through MySpace from one Howard Wolfson. At the time, I knew a man with the same name was helping run Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign, but I figured this must be a different guy, especially since Hillary was in the midst of battling Obama in the primaries. The best way to check whether it was that Howard Wolfson, I decided, was a Google search to see if he was Jewish. Because one key to growing your fan base is knowing your demographic, and my fan base was comprised entirely of depressed Jews. The search came up aces, but later on, I wrote to Howard just to make sure. I hope you don't mind my asking, I wrote, but Are you that Howard Wolfson? A few hours later, I had my answer. I am. Hope you're a Hillary fan. I never did ask what he was doing on my MySpace page during the primaries, but I wasn't totally surprised when Hillary lost.
Yeah. So that is a good question, what he was doing on your MySpace page. But the moral of the story is you got to do what it takes, right, to get out to your fans.
You do have to do what it takes to get out to your fans. I think being an artist is about following your own voice. And some people are really lucky in that what they want to do intersects exactly with the market. You know, there's just there are just two lines on a grid and they meet. You know, you've got J.K. Rowling and she really wants to tell the story of Harry Potter. And then lucky for her, there are 3 billion people that really want to hear that story. Whereas in my case, there are, you know, 600 people that really want to hear those songs. But it doesn't matter to me because I can't be any other way. I can't flip a switch and become Lady Gaga. There are people that say to me, why don't you write, you know, some dance music? You've got a great voice. You could do this and that. But the truth is I can't. I can't do anything but what I do, which is why I do it.
Alina Simone. Her album is called Make Your Own Danger. Her book is called You Must Go and Win. Alina, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Marketplace is supported by Barron's Magazine, providing market ideas and insights to help readers manage their investments and protect their financial well-being, online at barrons.com. By Reputation.com, helping small business owners, professionals, and executives monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations, Reputation.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering long-term strategies built on experience and research, on the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, and I'm not even sure I know the words for this, but you know that long, long, long-running suit the Winklevoss brothers filed against Facebook and founder Mark Zuckerberg? You know, the one they settled like 2 days ago? They have filed another one. They accuse Zuckerberg of suppressing evidence in the prior case. I offer that without any comment or coloration. Also, from the world of online hacking, Electronic Arts is the latest game company to be hacked. And in somewhat more serious news, the hacking group Lulzek says it has hacked into the files of the Arizona Department of Public Safety as an immigration protest, they said. All right, on a Friday, that's it. That's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow down 115 points, nearly 1%. The NASDAQ off 33 points. The S&P 500 dialed back 14 points today. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is a guy by the name of J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money. So you say you don't want to buy a house right now? So go ahead and rent. No, wait, don't do that.
It's been madness. Prices have gone up, and they're renting faster.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourself a great weekend. We are back here on Monday. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.